we're still in ring three, of course, in that meeting the teenage neurobiological impulse. And we are in the Northwest Strand, which is the cultural elements. And then we are on the fourth shield, which is the Southwest Shield. So we're at 3.4.6. And what we're talking about in this session is called mapping. Mapping. So today, I hear a lot of people saying, oh, I just love my GPS navigator, you know, whether it's on my Android or on my phone or built into my car, whatever it is, these things are amazing. As a matter of fact, I'd love to know by a show of hands if that's how you got here this morning. That's how I got here this morning. So I'm not saying get rid of that. As I was coming from Petaluma following my Google Map, you know, lovely person who was telling me how to get here, I remember thinking, wow, am I actually paying attention to where I am? You know, so if I flew above this place, or if later someone quizzed me, could I actually take my finger and show you where I went? Or am I allowing this device to completely give me the excuse to pay no attention at all to mapping? And as somebody who has studied a lot of eco-psychology over the years and neurological consequence of nature connection, I've been made really aware of the power of mapping. There's a man now, I was going to call him a young man, but I guess he's in his 40s, so for some of us that's a young man. And he's considered one of the greatest architects of his time and in his field, and he's designed buildings in Dubai and Paris and London, and he's renowned for his architecture. And all of the people who recognized his gift in his field, so it started to become, his professors began to single him out because he was showing up with this amazing gift, quote unquote. And they said that he was like savant or like genius in this particular area. And he came to me and he said, you know, I was staying with him in Paris because I was had a layover in Paris. And I stayed with him and his wife in their flat there. And we were talking about this and he was just musing with me, you know. And he said, you know, it's funny, John, that people would treat me like I had some kind of special thing going on. And it made me feel really awkward. But the only thing I had going on was that my peers didn't have it going on. And that when I traced back what they were saying I was capable of, they were talking about it like some high-level gift, but it's the stuff that I needed to have just to answer yours and Ingwe's questions at the end of any given day, after a nature connection day. And he said, if I can go back and trace my life and relive it, I can tell you without any doubt it was mapping. What you did with me with mapping that caused that quote-unquote gift to come out in me. But he says, it feels so natural. I don't think it's my gift. I think everybody must have this gift. It's just not developed. It's latent. It's basically atrophied. And I said, well, how does that affect your work? Why does mapping actually affect architecture? I don't really see the connection. He said, well, it's because I don't need a computer to visualize a project in all dimensions, not just three dimensions. It's like I can kind of move through the building in and out of it with my ability within my mind's eye. Or actually, he said, it's more like what you and Ingwe call the storyteller's mind, because it isn't just limited to my memory of sight. It's also my body gives me cues. There's things that are coming through my whole nervous system that are informing what I'm reliving. So I can literally walk into a project before it's done and see it as if it's still there, as if it's there, even though it's just on paper. And then I have the ability to then reduce that and render it, you know, in the way that I do. But he said, it's really, I can just go back and relive my life and realize that it was mapping nature that gave me that ability to have dynamic visualization capability. But again, remember, visualization is referring to one sensory system within our mind. It's really all sensory systems within the mind that we're referring to. So people have heard fascinating stories about San Bushmen and their capabilities as trackers. Okay, so Ingwe would say, you know, the Akamba were some of the best trackers in Africa, but any time the Akamba were stumped, In other words, they reached a place where they couldn't go further in the tracking if they were trying to follow somebody or find a fugitive or find a lost person or find game. They always pulled in a bushman because the bushman could always find it. They never failed, like never. And so the Yacamba said, we are good trackers, but the bushmen are profound trackers. And I've heard that again and again, everywhere around Africa. I've gotten to experience firsthand something that I'm going to share with you right now that relates to mapping, because it's such a curious story. So we, one day, there was apparently a dazzle of zebra at the waterhole. We missed that, but the tracks were everywhere, and they were all post-holed deep into the mud. So you couldn't see the actual footprints, you know, because they were deep down in the hole, right? So it was hard to tell. You knew it was a big animal, and you knew there was a lot of them. And they had come to the waterhole to drink, but a leopard, of course, was waiting at the waterhole because why wouldn't you? If you're a leopard, that's the place to wait. And so this leopard decided to jump on one of the zebra, and it got a hold of one of the arteries in its neck and had begun to throttle it, but the zebra ran into the waterhole, and the leopard jumped off and then went on the bank and then walked off into the forest. And out of the other side of the waterhole came a bleeding zebra that was limping. So this one bushman tracker spots those tracks. His name is Guta. Guta. Try to get the sounds at the same time. There's no delay. His name isn't Guta. It's Guta. So he sees this trail, he sees the blood, he sees the limping zebra, he looks up at the sun, and he says in Bushman, we have to get this zebra before the lions get it. It can feed the whole village. So that's all he says, and then he starts running. So then we're all running. And some of the people aren't really fit for running, so that one of the guides has to stay back and walk with people. But it's clear where we went, because there's several running tracks going in one direction. Of humans, so they can follow it pretty easily, right? We followed for 45 minutes at a dead run, never lost the trail of the zebra. It got dark. The sun set, went past twilight. We ended up against a big acacia forest patch, and there was no stars visible. There was no moon. There was clouds, and then there was dark. So, mind you, I am responsible for the well-being of the people that I've brought on this tourism thing here, okay? But I've kind of forgot that at this point. So it's getting dark, and the co-leader, who is also responsible, is with another group elsewhere. So it's now me and this bushman and these people. And there's several bushmen, so actually, you feel pretty safe when you're with them, you know, because you kind of know that they're going to know how to get out of whatever we get into anyway. So it usually, so far, it's worked out. So Guta says to me, I can literally, I'm not exaggerating, can't see my hand in front of my face because we tried to follow the zebra into the acacia forest, but it was black, so you could not see your hand in front of your face. So we step back up out into the diffused, almost no light situation, but the sand is glowing so you can see, right, enough. And Guta's English, he says to me, dark, leopard, truck. And that's when it hit me. We had no light, we had no gun, we had a lot of people. I had no idea where the truck was. Have you ever run across a landscape 45 minutes without stopping that's perfectly flat where everything looks the same? There's no mountains, there's no, you know, highway noise, there's no blinking red light to tell you where you are, there's nothing. And I just suddenly felt like, wow, okay, we may be spending the night right here. You know, that's kind of where I went. And I thought, well, it's time to build some thorn barrier and build a fire. We're going to probably be here. Well, no. He said that to me because he was about to execute a particular decisive move. And he literally went like this with his hand, and he turned like that, his hand dropped, and it was like a rope toe. It was like, if I'm aging myself, you know, he grabs a hold of the rope toe in some imaginary realm, and his hand is hooked to it, and he just starts going. And he just walked in a straight line for 20 minutes without breaking stride, perfectly straight line, And we ended up exactly at the truck. And I'm not saying like in the vicinity. We popped through the bushes. There's the truck. And I said to my friend Matt, did you just see what I just saw? He's like, are you talking about like the laser straightness to the truck? And I'm like, yeah, that. He's like, I know. So we talked to him about it. He just laughed. He didn't tell us anything. And then, okay, a year or two goes by. Now I'm back in the Kalahari with a famous Grammy Award-winning bass player, Victor Wooten. Plays with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. He's a jazz great, if you don't follow jazz. But if you ever get, when Victor comes to town at Yoshi's, do yourself a favor in the East Bay and go watch Victor Wooten and his band. You will be blown away by this guy's musicianship. Anyway, Victor loves tracking, of all things. He loves tracking. So he said, one day I'm coming to the Kalahari with you. He says, are they good trackers? I'm like, best in the world. He's like, oh, I gotta experience this, you know? So he comes this one year, and he says, do you think we could go tracking with these Bushmen, you know, follow something all day or something like you tell stories about? I'm like, yeah, I'm sure that's easy, you know, just be prepared to be hot and dehydrated and tired. So our friend Guta offers to trail a cheetah for us until we catch the, you know, we're going to catch up to the cheetah eventually, okay? Well, it took a while to find the cheetah tracks, but we eventually crossed a cheetah trail, and we followed this cheetah probably about 4 hours nonstop, and Guta was blowing everybody's mind because the cheetah was figured out we were following it, so it was doing evasive things and going into places where it didn't leave footprints, you know, going onto hard pan and stuff like that, but this man never lost the trail. It was like it was painted on the ground, and everybody was like, how did he see that, you know, and they would all stop and look, but then they'd realize he was already, you know, 100 yards ahead, and they had to go run to catch up with him, and that went on for a while, and people were hot and sunburned and dehydrated. Our water bottles were all empty, and we've been doing that for, you know, four and a half hours, right? Well, at this point, the cheetah was definitely showing signs that it was tiring, and it was getting hot, and we didn't want to push it any further because it needed to get water, it needed to rest. So when it found a farmer's fence to go under, we left it right there. And so I said to the trackers, and there was three trackers there besides Victor that were all super pumped on tracking and having an amazing time with these Bushmen. And he says, I said to them, come over here for a second, you know. So they all come over. I'm like, did you like what you just saw with Guta? Oh, that was, I'll never forget that the rest of my life. That was the most amazing thing, the way that guy could follow trails and read and understand what the cheetah's body language was. And they're talking about it. I said, but wait, you're about to have the most amazing experience yet. And they're like, what? I said, when I say something to him, he's going to turn around and start walking really briskly. I want you guys to line up behind him, and I want you to sight line and tell me if he veers off left or right or if he goes in a straight line the whole time. And I just want you to follow him. So keep looking in the distance for like a dead tree out there and see if you're going straight to it and see if he stays in a straight line the whole time, because this is going to blow your mind. And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, try it. You know, so I said, Guta, can you point directly to the truck? You know, and he gets up, he gets translated, he brushes off his legs, he looks at me and he goes, and off he goes, right? Straight line, you know? Again, about half hour, 40 minutes of straight walking nonstop. We break the brush, there's the truck exactly in front of his hand, you know, because it's another 20 yards out to where the truck is, but his hand is pointing right at the truck. Does anybody find that at all interesting? I think that's pretty interesting. You know, so many people lose their trucks. You know, they go for a hike, and then they spend the night, right? And they just can't find their truck. And then I hear other stories from other people who basically bump into their truck by accident. Or they find someone at a crowded mall who they lost track with and forgot to get the mobile number from, or didn't have mobile numbers in those times. And, oh, we forgot to say we were going to meet up, and the place is so crowded, and then you start worrying, and then your body sort of moves you, and then, bam, you end up in the right place at the right time. You know, and I see this ability cultivated in the Bushmen at a very high level. And obviously, if you're a Bushman, you need this ability. You know, you can't live without this ability. This is like a survival skill for them. They absolutely have to have this ability to know exactly where they are at any point on any landscape to a very high level. But what's that built on? I mean, we can't just go outside right now and do an exercise where we break into twos and then we just sort of magically have this ability, because there's so much neurological patterning behind what causes what I would just call synesthesia, the integration of all senses within this body to seem to do magical things, which aren't any magical at all if you grew up this way. This is stuff that they all do every day, you know? And as I walk with different indigenous people in different parts of the world, everybody recognizes the skill as something that they have to raise in their youth. They have to make sure the youth have this ability, because you can't get lost in the Kalahari when you're out gathering wood for the village. That's just a nuisance. Not just for you, but for the tribe has to stop what it's doing and then go find you, right? So it's not something you want your kids to do. You know what I mean? It's like you'd be like a bad parent if your kid was one of the ones that I'm going to go find Bob again. He's gone. Oh, yeah. Well, call Guta. We'll find him. So you understand, it's a matter of practicality. It's not a matter of, like, you know, telepathy. And in this case, if I didn't have the following thing to tell you, then I wouldn't bring this up at all, except as a mysterious story. But I can say to you very clearly that because of stories like our friend Peter the architect, you know, they have these quote-unquote savant magical abilities that are related to essentially mapping when they were young. So I have raised a number of people over the course of my 33 years of doing this who have developed Bushman-level ability in a whole bunch of categories, and none of them want to admit it. They won't admit it. One of them is a scientist who I will say nothing more, except that he's one of the premier wildlife scientists in North America, and his capability as a researcher is far beyond his peers. And they're all wondering, how does he consistently connect with this one species so dependably? We spend all this money, we have these machines, we have these radio collars. He doesn't seem to need any of it. And when he got on the study, we suddenly had a whole bunch of radio collared members of that species. And before he came on the team, we didn't have any. And for 2 years, we were trying to figure out how to catch him. And, you know, he personally collared 39 of them, right? So he says, well, I won't admit this to anybody. You know, so that's why I'm being really mysterious, because he doesn't want to be outed. But he's a professional researcher, and he's incredible. But where did he get this? Well, he got it from the same place that Peter got it for architecture. You know, it has to do with mapping. And here's how. So what does that mean? What do you mean mapping? Okay, so I come back from a hike. I've gone down to the catfish pond, and I've taken my fishing pole, as I was known to do. And on my way to the catfish pond, I walk down Warbler Corner, I cross the path of the hinge tree, I go down by the frog pond, I go up the hill behind Nankervis's barn, down through the locust grove, past the strawberry fields, past the peeper swamp, off the gray cliffs, down to the sand track, into the catfish pond, and that's where I go fishing. All right, and I spend some time fishing there, and then I catch a bunch of catfish, and I'm super stoked, and I'm going to go home and cook them. So I go home, and when I get home, I get a phone call from Tom. And he says to me, what'd you do today? And I said, well, I'm cooking the catfish right now. He's like, oh, great, where were you? I'm like, at the catfish pond. He says, how did you get there? So I said, well, I went through Drucker's Woods, through the main entrance, I turned left, went down by Warbler Corner, and I repeat all that stuff, right, that I just told you. He's like, how'd you get back? I'm like, I just walked straight back. He's like, what route did you take? I'm like, actually, I don't remember what route I took back. He's like, are you kidding me? I'm like, no. He's like, you walked back from the catfish pond, you don't know which way you went? I'm like, I do remember climbing the sand part of the cliffs, you know, going around the gray cliff up the dirt trail. I remember that. He said, well, where'd you go from there? I'm like, I don't remember. He's like, all right, I'll call you tomorrow. Well, then I just lay there in my bed that night thinking, how did I just walk across the landscape and not remember where I went? Have you ever done that? Of course you have. I mean, it's not different from, you know, looking at your watch and then someone asking you what time it is and then you have to look again. we can literally fall into these unconscious patterns where we actually go on autopilot and we stop paying attention. But what this man was doing was making me retrace every single step I took and asking me nuanced questions. And every time he talked to me, I had to tell him stories in map form. And in the beginning, there was no map, because in the beginning, there was my house, the cul-de-sac, the woods. Then there was a pond out there where I went fishing. And then that wasn't okay. So he would take a walk with me, and we would have an experience at a place. Warbler's Corner got named because we saw five different species of warbler in one May, and we just stood there and were just blown away because they'd all come down out of the treetops and they were feeding at eye level on these cherry blossoms from these little cherries that were growing in the forest on the insects that were all around. And we were having these direct visuals with sun shining on it in this one intersection where the trail makes a 90-degree bend. We called it Warbler Corner. And so now the land begins to be named. So now I can tell him, or he would ask me, how far were you from Warbler's Corner? And each time a story was told, another place would be named, and the landscape began to wake up. And do you know what happens to your mind when that happens? Because now I can literally tell you, as I'm walking to my sit spot, I hear my feet on the macadam, the pavement. I get to where the roots are hanging out because the ground is getting eroded from the horses going up and down in this one spot. I can smell the horse droppings. I can smell the spice bush at the same time. I can hear the wood thrushes singing, right? I can see the sunlight coming through the misty forest in these golden shafts. You see the little insects moving around. I can smell the oaks. I can smell the beech. I can feel the soft earth beneath my feet. I can walk that trail all the way to the catfish pond right now. Did you feel it? Did you go with me? Because it's in me. I am that place. That place is me. And it is mapping that causes that. So he would make me draw maps in my journal when I came back from walks. Because sometimes he didn't call me. And he said, if I don't call you, then write the story, draw a little hand-drawn map of where you went, put a little dotted line where your foot went, and mark all the landscape features. If you went by the lightning tree, because Grandfather Stalking Wolf did the same thing in the Pine Barrens. The Pine Barrens is a named landscape. The lightning tree, the medicine waters, the flesh of the mother. All these places are just places on a map, but they all have names, and the names have stories, and the stories connect us to all of our memories through all of our senses. We're hardwired for that. So eco-psychology research says that children who grow up without a sense of mapping grow up to be adults who don't know where they are in life and are lost in life. And when wilderness therapists take them out and give them basic mapping and orienteering skills, they come back with a sense of who they are and where they're going on their path in life. There's a direct neurological correspondence between our ability to navigate on a landscape from our sensory experiences of that place, emphasizing connection, and our ability to navigate life. I think that's pretty interesting and also pretty important, because one of the biggest feedback things you hear from young adults is they don't know who they are, where they're going, or where they are in their life. And then when you find out they have no orienteering experience, no mapping experience, and no relationship to a named landscape, you're not surprised. But when I do quote-unquote rehabilitation therapy for people like this, all I do is what I just told you. We go on adventures. I tell them stories about named points on the landscape to speed things up a little bit. Hey, this is the place where so-and-so had this experience, right? Here's the place where I caught my first snapping turtle. Here's the place, that I call the catfish pond. I literally just physically introduce them and tell them a story so the named landscape wakes up quicker. And I just love what the Bushmen do with this. They do this with their children. So here, have you ever wondered what to do with potty humor? As parents, have you ever been embarrassed because your kids use potty humor in front of the parents that you never wanted them to use it in front of? And you're like, what is this potty humor thing? Like, how do we get this out of the kids? It's like so embarrassing, and they do this, and it's so annoying, but they can't seem to stop. So when you're driving them from place to place in the car, they're in the back, and they're saying the funniest thing. They're whispering to each other, and they're laughing hysterically. And as you tune into what it is, it's usually something about poop or butts, right? And you're like, what is this? Well, guess what? The Bushmen kind of figured out how to leverage that. So they named their landscape using all potty humor references. They do. Everything on the landscape has a name that when you say it out loud and when they translate it into English, everybody snickers. And all the Bushmen are cracking up and trying not to look like they're laughing because there's all these tourists and they have to, you know, be professional. Right? But you can see them going like... And then the kids just laugh and then they run away because they're not allowed to laugh. And then they translate it. And then, you know, people on our group, they don't know what to say and they get red, you know, and the translator feels all odd, you know, because this really awkward thing had to happen. But do you think a kid would ever forget the name of a place if it was named, you know, like one of them is Big Man's Buttocks, you know, the Big Man's Big Fat Butt. Right, so it's the name of a rock formation. The kids all know exactly where that is and they never forget it. I know. That's leveraging something, right? That's like, whoa, they figured out how to like stack humor with potty talk, with named landscapes, with mapping. And it's just like, it takes care of itself from there. They don't have to think about it. You know, for us in modern times, what do we do with that? You know, it's you know, the simple thing, and you know, this is in Coyote's Guide as well, you know, just name landscapes. I mean, if we're sitting here at this beautiful nature center, I'm sure there's a named landscape around us. I'm sure that the person who left this place as a gift to the future probably named this landscape like crazy or probably had stories. You know, the docents maybe already know stories of this place, and the young people should be bringing stories of the place, and because the stories evolve and change. But then all of us, when we tell stories to each other about what we experienced, be sure to include how you got there, where you were exactly, and how you came back. The Bushmen would say, if you come back with the meat, in other words, you go hunting and you get some meat and you bring it back to the village, if you don't come back with the story, you might as well not bring back the meat. Because the people are waiting back at the village for the story. They're hungry, yes. They may be starving. They may not have eaten good food in a week, and they may literally be on the edge of starvation. However, if you come back without a story, you literally disgrace your family. And when they come back with a story, it has to include all of the landscape features so that anyone could go in their mind with them on that walk to the hunt and then come back with them on the route that they took. So interesting. You know, we can pull that right back right now. It doesn't matter. You know, I was in Petaluma and I had to go over here to get something. Tell the story of the little town as you walk through it. You know, where you saw the pigeons and where you heard the red tail. And you know, that one intersection that you have to look both ways because people always come around that corner really fast. You know, name these places. Why not? Connection doesn't have to only happen in the deep bush. It can happen anywhere and everywhere. You know, bring back mapping and continue to use your GPS so that we show up on time where we need to be when we need to be there. But ask yourself as you're driving, am I disconnecting from my mapping while relying on the mapping? And so what I tend to do is I tend to keep them both going. You know, I challenge myself to try to remember certain things about the route that I took to get here. You know, so, because I know what that's doing for me. And I think we can go a long way with that one, but that's a very deep pattern. And I would add to it that the mapping gets layered. And so as you tell stories, the layers include the low-growing plants. It incorporates the waters. It incorporates the animal tracks and scat and sign seen along the way. It incorporates the trees, the birds seen and heard. It incorporates the direction of the wind, the phase of the moon. Like, everything is fair game when you come back to the village. They're going to ask you questions about all of the following. Because the old herbalist wants to know if that particular plant was seen along the way. She wants to know. You're saving her a trip. Right? So when you come back, your stories don't belong to you. They belong to everybody who may harvest something from your story for their own specialty. So you walk with the sense that the story belongs to the people. You walk with this need to bring back a story, not just food. It's really awesome, you know, when you layer mapping with ecological resources and you learn that your brain is absolutely designed for this and how cool it is when it really wakes up. That next time you lose your truck in the Kalahari, you just have to drop your hand and get on that rope toe and off you go. That's handy. All right, thanks. It's mapping.